Bryn Mawr Commencement Address, 1986. Thinking about what I should say to you made me think about what we learn in college and what we unlearn in college, and then how we learn to unlearn what we learned in college and relearn what we unlearned in college, and so on. And I thought how I have learned, more or less well, three languages, all of them English, and how one of these languages is the one I went to college to learn. I thought I was going to study French and Italian, and I did, but what I learned was the language of power, of social power. I shall call it the father tongue. This is the public discourse, and one dialect of it is speech-making, by politicians, commencement speakers, or the old man who used to get up early in a village in central California a couple of hundred years ago and say things very loudly on the order of, "People need to be getting up now. There are things we might be doing. The repairs on the sweat house aren't finished, and the tarweed is in seed over on Bald Hill. This is a good time of day for doing things, and there'll be plenty of time for lying around when it gets hot this afternoon." So everybody would get up grumbling slightly, and some of them would go pick tarweed, probably the women. This is the effect, ideally, of the public discourse. It makes something happen, makes somebody, usually somebody else, do something. Or at least it gratifies the ego of the speaker. The difference between our politics and that of a native Californian people is clear in the style of the public discourse. The difference wasn't clear to the white invaders, who insisted on calling any Indian who made a speech a chief, because they couldn't comprehend, they wouldn't admit, an authority without supremacy, a non-dominating authority. But it is such an authority that I possess for the brief, we all hope it is decently brief, time I speak to you. I have no right to speak to you. What I have is the responsibility you have given me to speak to you. The political tongue speaks aloud. And look how radio and television have brought the language of politics right back where it belongs. But the dialect of the father tongue that you and I learned best in college is a written one. It doesn't speak itself. It only lectures. It began to develop when printing made written language common rather than rare, 500 years ago or so. And with electronic processing and copying, it continues to develop and proliferate so powerfully, so dominatingly, that many believe this dialect, the expository, and particularly the scientific discourse, is the highest form of language, the true language, of which all other uses of words are primitive vestiges. And it is indeed an excellent dialect. Newton's Principia was written in it in Latin, and Descartes wrote Latin and French in it, establishing some of its basic vocabulary, and Kant wrote German in it, and Marx, Darwin, Freud, Boas, Foucault, all the great scientists and social thinkers wrote it. It is the language of thought that seeks objectivity. I do not say it is the language of rational thought. Reason is a faculty far larger than mere objective thought. When either the political or the scientific discourse announces itself as the voice of reason, it is playing God and should be spanked and stood in the corner. The essential gesture of the father tongue is not reasoning, but distancing, making a gap, a space between the subject or self and the object or other. Enormous energy is generated by that rending, that forcing of a gap between man and world. So the continuous growth of technology and science fuels itself. The Industrial Revolution began with splitting the world atom, and still by breaking the continuum into unequal parts, we keep the imbalance from which our society draws the power that enables it to dominate every other culture. So that everywhere now everybody speaks the same language in laboratories and government buildings and headquarters and offices of business, and those who don't know it or won't speak it are silent or silenced or unheard. You came here to college to learn the language of power, to be empowered. If you want to succeed in business, government, law, engineering, science, education, the media, if you want to succeed, you have to be fluent in the language in which success is a meaningful word. White man speak with forked tongue. White man speak dichotomy. His language expresses the values of the split world, valuing the positive and devaluing the negative in each redivision. Subject-object, self-other, mind-body, dominant-submissive, active-passive, man-nature, man-woman, and so on. The father tongue is spoken from above. It goes one way. No answer is expected or heard. In our Constitution and the works of law, philosophy, social thought, and science, in its everyday uses, in the service of justice and clarity, what I call the father tongue is immensely noble and indispensably useful. When it claims a privileged relationship to reality, it becomes dangerous and potentially destructive. It describes with exquisite accuracy the continuing destruction of the planet's ecosystem by its speakers. This word from its vocabulary, ecosystem, is a word unnecessary, except in a discourse that excludes its speakers from the ecosystem in a subject-object dichotomy of terminal irresponsibility. The language of the fathers, of man ascending, man the conqueror, civilized man, is not your native tongue. It isn't anybody's native tongue. You didn't even hear the father tongue your first few years, except on the radio or TV, and then you didn't listen, and neither did your little brother, because it was some old politician with hairs in his nose yammering. And you and your brother had better things to do. You had another kind of power to learn. You were learning your mother tongue. Using the father tongue, I can speak of the mother tongue only, inevitably, to distance it, to exclude it. It is the other, inferior. It is primitive, inaccurate, unclear, coarse, limited, trivial, banal. It's repetitive, the same over and over, like the work called women's work. Earthbound, housebound. It's vulgar, the vulgar tongue, common, common speech, colloquial, low, ordinary, plebeian, like the work ordinary people do, the lives common people live. The mother tongue, spoken or written, expects an answer. It is conversation. A word the root of which means turning together. The mother tongue is language not as mere communication, but as relation, relationship. It connects. It goes two ways, many ways, an exchange, a network. Its power is not in dividing, but in binding. Not in distancing, but in uniting. It is written, but not by scribes and secretaries for posterity. It flies from the mouth on the breath that is our life and is gone, like the out-breath, utterly gone, and yet returning, repeated, the breath the same again, always, everywhere. And we all know it by heart. John, have you got your umbrella? I think it's going to rain. Can you come play with me? If I told you once, I told you 100 times. Things here just aren't the same without Mother. I will now sign your affectionate brother, James. Oh, what am I going to do? So I said to her, I said, if he thinks she's going to stand for that. But then there's his arthritis, poor thing, and no work. I love you. I hate you. I hate liver. Joan, dear, did you feed the sheep? Don't just stand around mooning. Tell me what they said. Tell me what you did. Oh, how my feet do hurt. My heart is breaking. Touch me here. Touch me again. Once bit, twice shy. You look like what the cat dragged in. What a beautiful night. Good morning, hello, goodbye, have a nice day, thanks. God damn you to hell, you lying cheat. Pass the soy sauce, please. Oh, shit. Is it Grandma's own sweet pretty dear? What am I going to tell her? There, there, don't cry. Go to sleep now, go to sleep. Don't go to sleep. It is a language always on the verge of silence, and often on the verge of song. It is the language stories are told in. It is the language spoken by all children and most women, and so I call it the mother tongue. For we learn it from our mothers and speak it to our kids. I'm trying to use it here in public where it isn't appropriate, not suited to the occasion. But I want to speak it to you because we are women, and I can't say what I want to say about women in the language of capital M, man. If I try to be objective, I will say, this is higher, and that is lower. I'll make a commencement speech about being successful in the battle of life. I'll lie to you. And I don't want to. Early this spring, I met a musician, the composer Pauline Oliveros, a beautiful woman, like a gray rock in a stream bed. And to a group of us women who were beginning to quarrel over theories in abstract, objective language, and I, with my splendid Eastern Women's College training in the father tongue, was in the thick of the fight and going for the kill, to us, Pauline, who is sparing with words, said, after clearing her throat, offer your experience as your truth. There was a short silence. When we started talking again, we didn't talk objectively. And we didn't fight. We went back to feeling our way into ideas, using the whole intellect, not half of it, talking with one another, which involves listening. We tried to offer our experience to one another. Not claiming something, offering something. How, after all, can one experience deny, negate, disprove another experience? Even if I've had a lot more of it, your experience is your truth. How can one being prove another being wrong? Even if you're a lot younger and smarter than me, my being is my truth. I can offer it. You don't have to take it. People can't contradict each other. Only words can. Words separated from experience for use as weapons. Words that make the wound, the split between subject and object, exposing and exploiting the object, but disguising and defending the subject. People crave objectivity, because to be subjective is to be embodied, to be a body, vulnerable, violable. Men, especially, aren't used to that. They're trained not to offer, but to attack. It's often easier for women to trust one another, to try to speak our experience in our own language, the language we talk to each other in, the mother tongue. So we empower one another. But you and I have learned to use the mother tongue only at home, or safe among friends. And many men learn not to speak it at all. They're taught that there's no safe place for them. From adolescence on, they talk a kind of degraded version of the father tongue with each other. Sports scores, job technicalities, sex technicalities, and TV politics. At home, to women and children talking mother tongue, they respond with a grunt and turn on the ball game. They have let themselves be silenced. And dimly they know it, and so resent speakers of the mother tongue. Women babble, gabble all the time. Can't listen to that stuff. Our schools and colleges, institutions of the patriarchy, generally teach us to listen to people in power, men or women speaking the father tongue. And so they teach us not to listen to the mother tongue, to what the powerless say, poor men, women, children, not to hear that as valid discourse. I am trying to unlearn these lessons, along with other lessons I was taught by my society, particularly lessons concerning the minds, work, works, and being of women. I am a slow unlearner, but I love my unteachers, the feminist thinkers and writers and talkers and poets and artists and singers and critics and friends, from Wollstonecraft and Woolf through the furies and glories of the 70s and 80s. I celebrate here and now the women who for two centuries have worked for our freedom, the unteachers, the unmasters, the unconquerors, the unwarriors, women who have at risk and at high cost offered their experience as truth. Let us not praise famous women, Virginia Woolf scribbled in a margin when she was writing Three Guineas, and she's right. But still, I have to praise these women and thank them for setting me free in my old age to learn my own language. The third language, my native tongue, which I will never know, though I've spent my life learning it. I'll say some words now in this language. First, a name. Just a person's name. You've heard it before. Sojourner Truth. That name is a language in itself. But Sojourner Truth spoke the unlearned language about 100 years ago. Talking it in a public place, she said, I have been 40 years a slave and 40 years free, and would be here 40 years more to have equal rights for all. Along at the end of her talk, she said, I wanted to tell you a mite about woman's rights, and so I came out and said so. I am sitting among you to watch, and every once in a while I will come out and tell you what time of night it is, she said. Now I will do a little singing. I have not heard any singing since I came here. Singing is one of the names of the language we never learn, and here, for Sojourner Truth, is a little singing. It was written by Joy Harjo of the Creek people, and is called The Blanket Around Her. Maybe it is her birth, which she holds close to herself. Or her death, which is just as inseparable. And the white wind that encircles her is a part, just as the blue sky hanging in turquoise from her neck. O woman, remember who you are, woman. It is the whole earth. So what am I talking about with this unlearned language? Poetry? Literature? Yes, but it can be speeches and science. Any use of language when it is spoken, written, read, heard as art. The way dancing is the body moving as art. In Sojourner Truth's words, you hear the coming together. The marriage of the public discourse and the private experience, making a power, a beautiful thing, the true discourse of reason. This is a wedding and welding back together of the alienated consciousness that I've been calling the father tongue and the undifferentiated engagement that I've been calling the mother tongue. This is their baby. This baby talk, the language you can spend your life trying to learn. We learn this tongue first, like the mother tongue, just by hearing it or reading it. And even in our overcrowded, underfunded public high schools, they still teach A Tale of Two Cities and Uncle Tom's Cabin. And in college, you can take 4 solid years of literature. And even creative writing courses. But it is all taught as if it were a dialect of the father tongue. Literature takes shape and life in the body, in the womb of the mother tongue, always. And the fathers of culture get anxious about paternity. They start talking about legitimacy. They steal the baby. They ensure by every means that the artist, the writer, is male. This involves intellectual abortion by centuries of women artists, infanticide of works by women writers, and a whole medical corps of sterilizing critics working to purify the canon, to reduce the subject matter and style of literature to something Ernest Hemingway could have understood. But this is our native tongue. This is our language they're stealing. We can read it, and we can write it. And what we bring to it is what it needs, the woman's tongue, that earth and savor, that relatedness, which speaks dark in the mother tongue, but clear as sunlight in women's poetry, and in our novels and stories, our letters, our journals, our speeches. If Sojourner Truth, 40 years a slave, knew she had the right to speak that speech, how about you? Will you let yourself be silenced? Will you listen to what men tell you? Or will you listen to what women are saying? I say, the canon has been spiked. And while the Eliots speak only to the Lowells and the Lowells speak only to God, Denise Levertov comes stepping westward quietly, speaking to us. There is no savor more sweet, more salt, than to be glad to be what? Woman? And who? Myself. I am a shadow that grows longer as the sun moves, drawn out on a thread of wonder. If I bear burdens, they begin to be remembered as gifts, goods. A basket of bread that hurts my shoulders but closes me in fragrance. I can eat as I go. As I've been using the word truth, in the sense of trying hard not to lie, So I use the words literature, art, in the sense of living well, living with skill, grace, energy, like carrying a basket of bread and smelling it and eating as you go. I don't mean only certain special products made by specially gifted people living in specially privileged garrets, studios, and ivory towers, high art. I mean also all the low arts, the ones men don't want. For instance, the art of making order where people live. In our culture, this activity is not considered an art. It is not even considered work. Do you work? And she, having stopped mopping the kitchen and picked up the baby to come answer the door, says, No, I don't work. People who make order where people live are, by doing so, stigmatized as unfit for higher pursuits. So, women mostly do it. And among women, poor, uneducated, or old women, more often than rich, educated, and young ones. Even so, many people want very much to keep house but can't, because they're poor and haven't got a house to keep, or the time and money it takes, or even the experience of ever having seen a decent house, a clean room, except on TV. Most men are prevented from housework by intense cultural bias. Many women actually hire another woman to do it for them because they're scared of getting trapped in it, ending up like the woman they hire, or like that woman we all know who's been pushed so far over by cultural bias that she can't stand up and crawls around the house, scrubbing and waxing and spraying germ killer on the kids. But even on her knee bones, where you and I will never join her, even she has been practicing as best she knows how a great, ancient, complex, and necessary art. That our society devalues it is evidence of the barbarity, the aesthetic and ethical bankruptcy of our society. As housekeeping is an art, so is cooking and all it involves. It involves, after all, agriculture, hunting, herding. So is the making of clothing and all it involves, and so on. You see how I want to revalue the word art so that when I come back, as I do now, to talking about words, it is in the context of the great arts of living, of the woman carrying the basket of bread, bearing gifts, goods. Art not as some ejaculative act of ego, but as a way, a skillful and powerful way of being in the world. I come back to words because words are my way of being in the world. But meaning by language as art, a matter infinitely larger than the so-called high forms. Here is a poem that tries to translate six words by Hélène Cixous, who wrote The Laugh of the Medusa. She said, Je suis là où ça parle. And I squeezed those six words like a lovely lemon, and got out all the juice I could, plus a drop of Oregon vodka. I'm there where it's talking, where that speaks. I am in that talking place, where that says my being is, where my being there is, speaking I am. And so, laughing in a stone ear. The stone ear that won't listen, won't hear us, that blames us for its being stone. Women can babble and chatter like monkeys in the wilderness, but the farms and orchards and gardens of language, the wheat fields of art. Men have claimed these, fenced them off. No trespassing. It's a man's world, they say. And I say, oh, woman, remember who you are, woman. It is the whole earth. We are told, in words and not in words, we are told by their deafness, by their stone ears, that our experience, the life experience of women, is not valuable to men, therefore not valuable to society, to humanity. We are valued by men only as an element of their experience, as things experienced. Anything we may say, anything we may do, is recognized only if said or done in their service. One thing we incontestably do is have babies. So we have babies as the male priests, lawmakers, and doctors tell us to have them, when and where to have them, how often, and how to have them. So that is all under control. But we are not to talk about having babies, because that is not part of the experience of men, and so nothing to do with reality, with civilization, and no concern of art. A rending scream in another room, and Prince Andrei comes in and sees his poor little wife dead, bearing his son. Or Levin goes out into his fields and thanks his God for the birth of his son. And we know how Prince Andrei feels, and how Levin feels, and even how God feels. But we don't know what happened. Something happened. Something was done, which we know nothing about. But what was it? Even in novels by women, we are only just beginning to find out what it is that happens in the other room, what women do. Freud famously said, "What we shall never know is what a woman wants." Having paused thoughtfully over the syntax of that sentence, in which we are plural, but a woman apparently has no plural, no individuality, as we might read that a cow must be milked twice a day or a gerbil is a nice pet, we might go on then to consider whether we know anything about, whether we have ever noticed, whether we have ever asked a woman what she does, what women do. Many anthropologists, some historians, and others have indeed been asking one another this question for some years now, with pale and affrighted faces. And they are beginning also to answer it. More power to them. The social sciences show us that speakers of the father tongue are capable of understanding and discussing the doings of the mothers, if they will admit the validity of the mother tongue and listen to what women say. But in society as a whole, the patriarchal mythology of what a woman does persists almost unexamined and shapes the lives of women. What are you going to do when you get out of school? Oh, well, just like any other woman, I guess I want a home and family. And that's fine. But what is this home and family just like other women's? Dad at work? Mom home, two kids eating apple pie. This family, which our media and now our government declare to be normal and impose as normative, this nuclear family now accounts for 7% of the arrangements women live in America. 93% of women don't live that way. They don't do that. Many wouldn't if you gave it to them with bells on. Those who want that, who believe it's their one true destiny, what's their chance of achieving it? They're on the road to Heartbreak House. But the only alternative offered by the patriarchal mythology is that of the failed woman, the old maid, the barren woman, the castrating bitch, the frigid wife, the lesbian, the liber, the unfeminine, so beloved of misogynists, both male and female. Now, indeed, there are women who want to be female men. Their role model is Margaret Thatcher, and they're ready to dress for success, carry designer briefcases, kill for promotion, and drink the right scotch. They want to buy into the man's world, whatever the cost. And if that's true desire, not just compulsion born of fear, okay. If you can't lick 'em, join 'em. My problem with that is that I can't see it as a good life even for men who invented it and make all the rules. There's power in it, but not the kind of power I respect, not the kind of power that sets anybody free. I hate to see an intelligent woman voluntarily double herself up to get under the bottom line. Talk about crawling. And when she talks, what can she talk but father tongue? If she's the mouthpiece for the man's world, what has she got to say for herself? Some women manage it. They may collude, but they don't sell out as women. And we know that when they speak for those who, in the man's world, are the others, women, children, the poor. But it is dangerous to put on daddy's clothes, though not perhaps as dangerous as it is to sit on daddy's knees. There's no way you can offer your experience as your truth if you deny your experience, if you try to be a mythical creature, the dummy woman who sits there on Big Daddy's lap. Whose voice will come out of her prettily hinged jaw? Who is it says yes all the time? Oh, yes, yes, I will. Oh, I don't know, you decide. Oh, I can't do that. Yes, hit me. Yes, rape me. Yes, save me. Oh, yes. That is how a woman talks. The one in What We Shall Never Know Is What a Woman Wants. A woman's place, need I say, is in the home. Plus, at her volunteer work, or the job where she's glad to get 60 cents for doing what men get paid a dollar for, but that's because she's always on pregnancy leave. But childcare? No. A woman is home, caring for her children, even if she can't. Trapped in this well-built trap, a woman blames her mother for luring her into it, while ensuring that her own daughter never gets out. She recoils from the idea of sisterhood and doesn't believe women have friends because it probably means something unnatural. And anyhow, a woman is afraid of women. She's a male construct, and she's afraid women will deconstruct her. She's afraid of everything because she can't change. Thighs forever thin, and shining hair and shining teeth, and she's my mom, too. All 7% of her. And she never grows old. There are old women. Little old ladies, as people always say. Little bits. Fragments of the great dummy statue goddess, a woman. Nobody hears if old women say yes or no. Nobody pays them 60 cents for anything. Old men run things. Old men run the show, press the buttons, make the wars, make the money. In the man's world, the old man's world, the young men run and run and run until they drop, and some of the young women run with them. But old women live in the cracks, between the walls, like roaches, like mice. A rustling sound, a squeaking. Better lock up the cheese, boys. It's terrible. You turn up a corner of civilization, and there are all these old women running around on the wrong side. I say to you, you know, you're going to get old. And you can't hear me. I squeak between the walls. I've walked through the mirror and am on the other side, where things are all backwards. You may look with a good will and a generous heart, but you can't see anything in the mirror but your own face. And I, looking from the dark side and seeing your beautiful young faces, see that that's how it should be. But when you look at yourself in the mirror, I hope you see yourself, not one of the myths, not a failed man, a person who can never succeed because success is basically defined as being male, and not a failed goddess, a person desperately trying to hide herself in the dummy woman, the image of men's desires and fears. I hope you look away from those myths and into your own eyes and see your own strength. You're going to need it. I hope you don't try to take your strength from men or from a man. Second-hand experience breaks down a block from the car lot. I hope you'll take and make your own soul. That you'll feel your life for yourself, pain by pain and joy by joy. That you'll feed your life. Eat. Eat as you go. You who nourish, be nourished. If being a cog in the machine or a puppet manipulated by others isn't what you want, you can find out what you want. Your needs, desires, truths, powers, by accepting your own experience as a woman, as this woman, this body, this person, your hungry self. On the maps drawn by men, there is an immense white area, terra incognita, where most women live. That country is all yours to explore, to inhabit, to describe. But none of us lives there alone. Being human isn't something people can bring off alone. We need other people in order to be people. We need one another. If a woman sees other women as Medusa, fears them, turns a stone ear to them these days, all her hair may begin to stand up on end, hissing, "Listen, listen, listen. Listen to other women, your sisters, your mothers, your grandmothers. If you don't hear them, how will you ever understand what your daughter says to you?" And the men who can talk, converse with you, not trying to talk through the dummy yes woman, the men who can accept your experience as valid. When you find such a man, love him, honor him, but don't obey him. I don't think we have any right to obedience. I think we have a responsibility to freedom. And especially to freedom of speech. Obedience is silent. It does not answer. It is contained. Here is a disobedient woman speaking. Wendy Rose of the Hopi and Miwok people. Saying in a poem called The Parts of a Poet. Parts of me are pinned to earth. Parts of me undermine song. Parts of me spread on the water. Parts of me form a rainbow bridge. Parts of me follow the sandfish. Parts of me are a woman who judges. Now this is what I want. I want to hear your judgments. I am sick of the silence of women. I want to hear you speaking all the languages, offering your experience as your truth, as human truth, talking about working, about making, about unmaking, about eating, about cooking, about feeding, about taking in seed and giving out life, about killing, about feeling, about thinking, about what women do, about what men do, about war, about peace, about who presses the buttons and what buttons get pressed, and whether pressing buttons is, in the long run, a fit occupation for human beings. There's a lot of things I want to hear you talk about. This is what I don't want. I don't want what men have. I'm glad to let them do their work and talk their talk, but I do not want and will not have them saying or thinking or telling us that theirs is the only fit work or speech for human beings. Let them not take our work, our words from us. If they can, if they will, let them work with us and talk with us. We can all talk mother tongue. We can all talk father tongue. And together, we can try to hear and speak that language, which may be our truest way of being in the world. We who speak for a world that has no words but ours. I know that many men, and even women, are afraid and angry when women do speak, because in this barbaric society, when women speak truly, they speak subversively. They can't help it. If you're underneath, if you're kept down, you break out, you subvert. We are volcanoes. When we women offer our experience as our truth, as human truth, all the maps change. There are new mountains. That's what I want. To hear you erupting. You young Mount St. Helens's who don't know the power in you, I want to hear you. I want to listen to you talking to each other and to us all. Whether you're writing an article or a poem or a letter or teaching a class or talking with friends or reading a novel or making a speech or proposing a law or giving a judgment or singing the baby to sleep, or discussing the fate of nations, I want to hear you. Speak with a woman's tongue. Come out and tell us what time of night it is. Don't let us sink back into silence. If we don't tell our truth, who will? Who'll speak for my children and yours? So I end with the end of a poem by Linda Hogan of the Chickasaw people, called The Women Speaking. Daughters, the women are speaking. They arrive over the wise distances on perfect feet. Daughters, I love you.